Okay, we're going to learn today about something very unique. You know, in the parsha of this week, Parshat Tzav, the upcoming parsha, is speaking a lot about sacrifices and the altar. The altar was the focal point of the temple. The ark was closed up inside the Holy of Holies. Turn on the heat a little bit. People are freezing here
warmer.
Tonight. Yeah. Then just you know, just make it up a little bit. Then not 12 degrees, no, 1 degree. But if not, I'll send them back to reduce it later. Then the altar, but what was the life of the temple was the altar, sacrifices. People came to the temple. They didn't come for the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was closed up. The high priest saw it once a year, if he saw anything. He walked in for a second. I talked a few times, but for very short periods of time. The altar was everything. It's written there should be a fire on the altar. And let's read first of all about the altar. Then we'll go to a story from the Talmud about the altar. Go for it.
The altar. God spoke to Moses saying, the man Aaron and his sons saying, this is the law of the burnt offering. That is the burnt offering which burns on the altar all night until morning. And the fire of the altar shall burn with it. The Kohen shall don his linen robe, and he shall don his linen pants on his flesh. He shall lift out the ashes into which the fire has consumed the burnt offering upon the altar, and put them down next to the altar. He shall then take off his garments and put on other garments, and he shall take out the ashes to a clean place outside the camp. The fire in the altar shall burn, it shall not go out. Kohen shall kindle wood upon it every morning, and upon it he shall arrange the burnt offering and cause the fats of the peace offerings to go up and smoke upon it. A continuous fire shall burn upon the altar. It shall not go out.
The main thing about the altar, it says to be on fire constantly. The fire has to be on. During the first temple, the fire was burning there miraculously. Still, it was a mitzvah to make sure there is enough wood. Even on Shabbos, even on Yom Tov, even on Yom Kippur, you have to make sure there is a fire there. On the holiday itself, you're allowed to do it. You have some mitzvah. In the second temple, only the first high priest who was there, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, no, Shimon HaTzadik, Shiori Knesset HaGdoilo, he was the one that during his time it was used to burn miraculously, but later the Kohen Gadol were a little shvach. And the best indicator if they are shvach or not, if there is a miracle happening because of them. There was no miracles because of them. But the mitzvah was to keep it going, to keep the fire going. This is about the altar. Now, boy, what are you doing? Now we're going to learn about a story in the time of the Hashmonaim, in the time of the Maccabees, that during this time, a story that happened with the altar, with the temple, during the time of the Maccabees. Okay, then we'll start to read the story. We'll start to read the story. Okay.
The story of a young woman. An entire family bears the consequence. Source 2, Talmud Sukkah. The sages taught a young woman named Miriam, the daughter of Bilgah, renounced her faith and went and married a Greek officer. When the Greeks entered the Holy Temple, Miriam followed them, kicking the altar with her shoes, saying, "Wolf, wolf, for how long will you continue to consume the property of the Jewish people and yet fail to assist them when they are in trouble?" When the sages heard what happened, they fixed the Bilgah family's ring in place and closed their alcove.
Okay, what happened? Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis tell us that story. A story with a woman and the name Miriam. Not my wife, another man. The daughter of Bilgah. Bilgah was a name of a father. This still looks like a name of a woman, but it was the name of a man. That she converted to, she denounced irreligion. She went to the other religion, to the Greek religion, whatever the religion was at that time. And she married to a Greek officer. This is the time of when the Greeks are fighting Judaism and conquering the temple and entering the temple and putting the Zeus inside the temple, the idol, and doing in the temple whatever they want. She married one of these guys. And when they finally, Ada went by a marched inside the temple, the Greeks took over. She walked with them and she saw into inside the altar, inside the temple. And she took off her shoe and she hit the altar with the shoe. It was like an insult, you know, by the Arabs, by the many cultures, you throw somebody a shoe, that's the biggest insult. Remember, it was, they did it to President Bush, and he was a clever man. He was quick, he was sharp. It was very impressive. And she said, what she said to them, she told them, Lucas, 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 Lucas. You know, there is a name Lucas. Many people have named Lucas. Lucas in Greek is wolf. She called the temple wolf, wolf. For how long you're going to consume the money of the Jewish people by taking the sacrifices, but you're not there to help them, but they need your help. And when the rabbis took over the temple back, when they heard the story, they said they punished the group. You know, it was 24 shifts of coins. The coins in the temple, you know, there were thousands of coins. They were divided into 24 shifts. Every shift had a week to come to the temple to serve in Jerusalem. All year, they lived everywhere in Israel. They came for the week. 24 weeks, then there was another. Then basically every shift had a chance twice a year to be for a week. Bilgo shift was a shift too. It was a group under the name of Bilgo. Or it was a part of a shift. That the rabbis punished them. What they punished them in two things. Number one, it used to be a ring where they used to put the animal before the slaughtering inside the altar, inside the temple. The temple was a little bit like a slaughterhouse. You need to understand. It wasn't such a clean place, like, you know, they had to wash it every time. But it was Freilach there. They had to slaughter animals. That every group, every shift had their own ring. Like almost like a pole with a ring on top of it, then the animal, you can hold on to the animal before you slaughter it. To be able to slaughter it kosher, you need to make sure the animal doesn't move. There were 24 rings that they took, they closed up the ring. They cannot use the ring. This group cannot use the ring as a punishment, as a fine for what a girl from their community did, from their group did. And then another thing is a clove. It was like a lacquer where they used to put the knives of the, you know, they have to slaughter the animals. You have a special knife for the shochet, very sharp knives. Don't play around with this, I can tell you that. Then every group had their own knives because, you know, you have to, the knife has to make sure they're kosher, they're sharp, and every group was responsible for their knife. They didn't allow anybody else to use their knife. Then they closed down their lacquer. Punishment because a daughter from their family, not only she intermarried to the Greek, to the enemy of the Jewish people, she entered the temple, she hit the altar and she insulted the altar. That's the story in the town. Okay. Continue.
Why was the entire family punished? Bai said, the reason follows the common adage, a child's conversations street are what they picked up at home. Parents.
You got it. Yeah, what? It's only my child. Your child. What do you think she learned? Where she learned what she did? She heard it at home. That's why. Maybe she didn't hear exactly the same line, but she got it from somewhere. That's how Judaism looks at things. That's how important parenting is all about. Continue.
Why was the entire extended family punished on account of your father?
Yeah.
I said, the verse states, woe is to the sinner, woe is to their neighbor.
Oh, ay, 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 ay. You're a neighbor of a bad guy, you pay the price. It means to say you punish for him. What does this mean on a deeper level? If you're around, what means if the neighbor is wicked? It means because I didn't do the job. My neighbor is wicked. If I would be really righteous, I would inspire him. If I didn't inspire him, obviously I'm not so righteous. That's number one. Number two, if he's wicked, he influences me too. Basically, tell me who your friends are, I'll tell you who you are, right? That's an old saying, Galatian saying, and everybody says the same thing. Then that's, you look at your friend, and then when they're in trouble, you know, if you hang around gangsters, then the police arrest a few of them, you're being arrested too. But I never did anything wrong. That's your friend, right? Don't complain. Continue.
Concludes on a positive. Good for the righteous one and good for their neighbor.
It's not the book conclude. What kind of a translation is this? The tractate of the Talmud ends with this story. Suke, go ahead. Abaye is a Talmudic a rabbi, yeah, Abaye. His name is actually not Abaye. His name is something else. I'll remember in a minute, but they called him Abaye because he was an orphan and his uncle had the same name. Therefore, they changed his name. It was somebody in the house was well, the same name and they didn't want to, it was not respectful to call him by their name. Therefore, they called him Abaye. In a minute, I'll tell you who is Abaye. One second. I just saw it and I forgot. I'm getting old, you see? That's what happens. Abaye. Yeah. His name was Nachmeni. And they changed his name to Abaye because his uncle, his name was Nachmeni, and his father died, and his uncle adopted him. And his uncle was Rabbi Bar Nachmeni. And because his father was Nachmeni, he didn't want to call the child with the same name of his father. That's disrespectful for his father. Therefore, he gave him the name Abaye. Abaye is an acronym for the word Asher Becha Yerucham Yatom. It means to say because it's a verse that speaks about an orphan, Yatom. That's why. And this is Abaye. What a good question. Go ahead, continue.
As the verse states, praise the righteous man for he is good, for the fruit of their deeds they shall eat. Even the righteous one's neighbors benefit from his presence.
From being a righteous man, if you're around a righteous person, things will be good for you because Hashem protects the righteous and anybody around them benefits from it. What do you think? That's the way it goes. That's how business goes. Choose your neighborhood. Everybody chooses his neighborhood, yeah? Continue what Rashi says about this.
Miriam, the daughter of Judah, built a ship in the temple.
Yeah, that was the name of the shift.
The Greeks entered the temple after the Hasmonean recaptured it.
Not after, before. That's a mistake.
When the sages heard, when the Hasmonean gained the upper hand,
when the Hashmonaim gave the upper hand, they punished them. What they did, they closed the cloth. Go ahead, the last. Exactly, of the shift. That's what Rashi says, what they did. Okay. Joe, do you want to continue? But the Rebbe comes the Rebbe. A lover of every Jew, even of a Jewish girl who died 2,000 years ago, 2,500, over 2,000 years ago, 2,300 years ago. And the Rebbe can't take such a story. He just can't. This story must have. And he puts a whole different spin on this story. It's a different story. Well, the first question he says, what are you embarrassing a Jewish girl? What is this? Publicizing? It was a girl with the name Miriam? What is this? What is this, shaming? What is this, TikTok? Go ahead.
They just said the Torah doesn't speak negatively, even if it hasn't been for them, how much more so regarding the human, rather than the Torah.
You know, there is in the Bible, when the Torah says about in the in the in the in about the kosher animal and not kosher animal. When the Torah is speaking about it, it tells Noah he should enter into the inside the ark kosher animals and not kosher animals. You know, in Hebrew, there is a name for not kosher animals. What's the name? Another name?
Trey.
Impure Trey. Animal. Impure animal. Impure.
Oh. Impure is
Tameh. Not kosher is treif, but right. For pure and impure is tameh and taor. Taor is pure, tameh is impure.
Ah. Is treif more Yiddish?
Treif is a word in Hebrew that became Yiddish. Taref is in Hebrew. Treifa means the animal was attacked. If an animal was attacked and you find her in the street, you're not allowed to eat her. She's dead in them because she was attacked. It became a word in Yiddish, treif. From taref became treif. Yeah, but that's a word from the Bible. But taor and tameh. Then there is a word in English, there is no word for tameh. They say the impure animal. But in Hebrew, there is a word for it. Still, the Torah, when the Torah tells Noah, God tells Noah to take the animals inside the ark, he tells them the pure animals take seven of them, seven sets. The impure animals take two, take one set. But the Torah doesn't say the tameh animal. The Torah adds another few words, the impure animal. Why is the Torah putting extra words? Not to use a bad word, a negative expression, and an animal. Let's read it, source number three. Jot, continue.
Never let it to purgatory, will it come all of your life? Does the Torah use eight extra letters in you? Will the Lord say something unclean, as it says?
Then if for an animal of Torah adds, you know, think about writing in the Bible, the Torah, scribe, ink, even today it's a huge job. Then you write only when you must write. That the Torah just to teach us to avoid impure expressions. And an animal, the Torah giving extra word. How much more than...
Instead of referring to the incident of Miriam Bas Gilgal, Talmud could have sufficed referring to it as the incident of the young woman.
An unnamed person did A, B, and C. The story is much, it's dead. When you don't say write a name, somebody said A, B, means nothing. Without the name, the whole juice is lost. But, and I'll tell you why the Rebbe is asking the question. He didn't ask because it was a nice question. Because he lived by it. That's why I asked the question. The Rebbe never said a negative term, ever. On anything. He twisted verses in the Bible who have a negative term. He twisted the Bible line, Pashut Talmudic lines. And it was a master job. It was like unbelievable how he did it. Many times I listened to a tape from the Rebbe. I remember when he said it, and that was it. Whoa! It's geniusness how to turn every negative statement in the Talmud into a positive statement. I can give a class about it a lot. That's what he's asking. Why sing the name? Why? Say the story. You need to tell the story for people to learn for generations. Why names? Okay. Continue. Historical background.
Historical background. The incident of Miriam Bas Gilgal took place during the period of Matityahu and Yonatan, during which there was severe oppression against Judaism. We describe this era in Maimonides' Scene Prayer. The wicked Hellenic government rose up against your people Israel to make them forget your Torah. In the words of Maimonides, preaching and issued decrees and decrees against the Jewish people attempting to destroy their religion. As commandments. They extended their hands against their property as daughters. They entered the sanctuary, made the sacraments.
The Rebbe wants to give us a background. Drawing the when was it? You know, when you read a story and you don't know when it happened, what was the background? I can't believe it. A girl went. When, where, what? That's a different story. It was a time. The Greeks' time, they made such decrees on the Jewish people, you couldn't survive as a Jew. Judaism, the Jewish people were in the bottom of the bottom. That the decrees that they made against Judaism were, and anybody was caught doing something Jewish was executed in public. It was terrible times in the time of the Greeks. And we bring you source number four from Edrash Hanukkah. You read the four things that they told people, the decrees that they made against the Jews. Go ahead.
The sages thought, during the days of the wicked Greek Empire, they decreed upon the Jewish people. First, anyone who has a bolt in his house should engrave on it that the haters of Israel, merciful the Jews, have no share in the gods of Israel.
They said the order on your vault. Vault is like almost like a lock to your walls, like to your door, something like this. You should write on the vault that you don't believe in God. You have no share in the God of Israel. A Jew had to engrave it on his wall, on his lock, whatever it was, or maybe they used to close the door with it, something like this. And what the Jews did?
The Jews people immediately went and uprooted their walls from their houses.
They couldn't go against the government. They didn't want to do it. They said, I don't have it anymore. What should I do? I don't have it yet. They tried to survive. They didn't want to fight. They tried to survive one after the other. Finally, Matityahu started the whole rebellion against the Greeks. But for a long time, the Jews tried to avoid a fight. Then we will not do this. Then we will not do this. Then we will not go there. Here is the second example. Continue. Second, until came one Russian Jew like Matityahu and said, enough of this garbage.
They further decreed that everyone who owns an ox should write on it foreign, that the haters of Israel have no part in the God of Israel. The Jewish people went and sold their oxen.
Looks like it was a style to do what it's called, tattooing on the horns of the axe. That they wanted it should make a tattoo that will represent that they don't believe in God, they believe in idol or something. That the Jews sold their axes. That means they tried to avoid everything. They didn't want to do it, but on the other, they couldn't go against the government, they sold the axes.
Rabbi, why are they using the expression, the haters of Israel?
Because you don't want to say the Jews. We it's a euphemism. You say,
reverse. I mean,
that's the point. That's exactly the point. You know, there is, for example, in the Talmud, somebody who is blind, they call him Saginor. Saginor means he sees very good. Instead of saying, again, it's back to the same shtick, not to say bad things. Then you won't do it, don't say, and when many times it's written, God wanted to destroy the Jewish people, we say God wanted to destroy the enemies of the Jewish people. You don't even want to say with your mouth such words.
No,
it's talking about the Jews. Instead of saying the Jews, you say the haters of Israel.
Did I buy some matzah?
Okay. What?
I didn't have to because I came to Indiana and I went to a safe.
Hello, close this
place. I went to a Passover.
Even the wrong
and
place.
And brought some matzah home.
Thank you. That's what happens. You said like in the story. The close is his window. Okay. Go ahead. And number three.
The further decree that the man should cohabitate with their wives while they are in the state of Nida. The Jewish people went and separated from their wives.
They didn't allow them to wash in bed to go to the rivers because the Jews are contaminating the water. Then what the Jews did, they said, they will not have children. They cannot go to the mikveh. They will not have children. Then they went to follow them.
They further decreed that before anyone marries a woman, the woman must first cohabitate with the ruler first, and only then be given to her husband.
And it was known. That was one of the causes that started the whole war against the Greeks.
There are sentences here following them.
Some of them didn't get married. Many of them didn't get married. That's true. Okay, source number five.
Oh, at that time, Antiochus, who got up and sent his general Nicanor with a large force to Jerusalem, they killed many there and built an altar on the holy temple where God had told the Jews. he would rest forever. Oh, when God had told the Jews he would rest forever, they slaughtered the pig and brought the blood to the holy chamber.
You see what happened? That was like the top. He sent the general, Nicanor was his name, killed many people in Judah, obviously, it was a big war. Then he entered the temple and he slaughtered a pig. That was what the Matityahu's war started from this too. They forced him to slaughter a pig, to offer a pig as a sacrifice. Then this is the background. That's what was going on. You can imagine that the Jewish people were in the bottom of the bottom, Greeks were in the top of the top. Marrying a Greek officer was going out from jail to becoming in 1 minute, becoming a part of the winners, not a part of the losers, the part of the persecuted Jews who are being killed and slaughtered and tortured and obviously don't have money, don't have anything. Now we'll ask from Mrs. Kosoff.
Even when the state of Jewish education is good, it is extremely difficult to resist the pressure and not be negatively affected by the long-term state of darkness that the Greeks inflicted upon the Jewish people. The Greeks left the temple standing, unlike the Romans who destroyed and burned the temple, but they controlled and operated it.
Operated it. What's going on is like this. The Rebbe points out, in a good day, it's out to stand the pressure of society. And everybody's doing this, and everybody's doing this, and you have to be against them. You have to be a little bit of a sugar now, stubborn. How much more? Now, it says, the Rebbe says, to a point what the Greeks did was worse than the Romans. The Romans destroyed the temple, finished, there's no temple. To have a temple, and the temple is standing, and the Greeks are doing in the temple whatever they want, and God doesn't do anything. A Jew is not allowed to enter the temple on Yom Kippur, only the high priest. And here they're walking in, they're doing whatever they want, and everything is good. Go ahead. Dr. Kosser, would you?
Surely. They allowed for the menorah to be kindled, but insisted that it be done with impure oil. They allowed sacrifices, but only pigs. The Jewish people saw the Greeks strolling freely through the temple, through its courtyard, sanctuary, and even the Holy of Holies, a place where only the high priest was allowed to enter once a year for a specific service, and improper entry was a capital offense. The Greeks were operating the temple according to their rules, with their priests and sacrificial rites. In some respects, this situation was even worse than the destruction of the temple. Despite the Jews' desperate state, God was not saving them.
See, sometimes destruction, it's, you move on. When the temple is standing, and every day people violate the temple, and God is doing nothing, then the questions to hold on to your religion, to hold on to your belief, is much harder. You know, it's much easier to jump into the fire once than to fight for your Judaism every day. The Talmud says that, you know, there is a story about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the three people that Nebuchadnezzar said, if you don't bow down to the idol that he built, you'll be thrown into the furnace. And they were thrown into the furnace and they came out alive. But the Talmud says, if they would have to go through this every day, if they would have to fight it every day, it would be harder than being thrown into the furnace. A continuous, consistent fight for Judaism. The Rebbe pointed out many times when he spoke about Russian Jewry, that they were fighting every day for the Judaism, that it's even harder, he pointed out from the Talmud, that's harder what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did, that they jumped into the fire, it's a one-time thing, Nachshon and Aminado, jumped into the water, whatever it is, to life, to death, and be done. But every day waking up and fighting, and educating your kids to be Jewish and putting on your tefillin under the blanket because maybe your child will see it and you go to school and say something and you'll be in trouble and so on and on. This is harder than, and that's what the Rebbe said. What happened during the Greeks was worse than the Roman time. This is the background from where the gold is coming. Okay, Dr. Olchin, you want to continue?
Logically, under such difficult circumstances, with God's presence so concealed, there should have been quite a number of people abandoning the Jewish religion. The Talmud is therefore relating praise of the Jewish people when it describes the incident of Miriam Bas Bila Belgad with the same of the girl. This is similar to the sage's explanation of the verse spelling out the name of the woman who acted improperly. His mother was Shalomit, but Bat Divri of the tribe of Dan. The sages explained by spelling out her name of a woman who acted improperly. His mother was Shalomit. Oh, I did that. The sages explained by spelling out her name, the verses stating the praise of the Jewish people, implying that she was the only one to do this.
Let's stop right here. The Rebbe points out why the question was, why Miriam? Why to say the name? That the Talmud wants to make a point that was the only girl. It was one Miriam. That's it. Everybody else never did it. That's why the Torah, the Talmud is going to say the name. By saying the name, be praising the rest of the Jewish people. That's number one. Where we see a similar story, there is in, who is Shlomit Bat Divri? Who knows anything about Shlomit? Mr. Doctor? Cousin? Shlomit, yeah.
Was the mother of the first
God, right? Was one of the blasphemy. There was a story in the Bible that in the desert a man came out and cursed the name of God. He was the son of Shlomit Bat Divri. An Egyptian father. Remember? She was the girl. She had relations with the Egyptian officer that Moses killed. Then the Talmud says, the question is the same question. Why Shlomit? Why you write the name? To say that was one Jewish woman who had relations with an Egyptian guy. That's it. Nobody else did that. The Rebbe said the same thing here. They mentioned Miriam Bas Bilgo because that was the only one story. Nobody else, there is no recorded of any other story of somebody did such or something like this. Then from the number one, by saying it, you praise the Jewish people. Number two, it's a tikkun for you too. You understand? When we use your name to praise the rest of the Jewish people, it's an elevation for this person itself. And from his bad story comes out a praise for the Jewish people, it's a good thing for him too. And that's what it's all about. They continued, the Jewish woman, I'm sorry, I stopped in the middle.
The Jewish woman and girls suffered the Greek oppression more than the males. As Maimonides writes, the Greeks extended their hand against their daughters. Nevertheless, there was only one Jewish girl who strayed. And this is why her name is spelled out, Miriam, the daughter of Bilag.
Of Bilga. Bilga. You see, there is the Rebbe speaking about, you know, for Noah, everybody says, Noah was a bad guy. He didn't care for the Jewish, for the people. He didn't pray for them. And Rebbe asked, what is this business of going and smearing Noah, shaming Noah in public? What is this business? And the Rebbe said the same idea. The tikkun of Noah is when people don't learn from it. The correction, the atonement for Noah. How you correct Noah's mistake? When you point out, don't learn from Noah. And the bad guy in every goes around and says, don't learn from me, don't learn from me. We need also this guy, you understand? Then that's how you're helping his neshama. You understand what I'm saying? It's not that we are here to shame him. We are helping his neshama by bringing praise to everybody else that they didn't do it. Tony, it's you too. We have to unmute you 1 second.
Now he has to mute himself.
Let Susan go. Let Susan read.
Young man, you were busy with another phone call.
Okay. Okay, I'll read. Judging favorably manifests the positive. In addition to praise for the Jewish people as a whole, the Talmud is also teaching us the praise of Miriam Bat Bilga herself.
And first of all, we show that she's the only one. But really, there is a positive story about Miriam itself. That's only the Rebbe can accomplish. Go ahead, continue.
There is no reason to question the effort to highlight positive points about Miriam by Bilga, because the Torah teaches that we should always search for the positive regarding every Jew. As the Mishnah states, judge every person to the side of merit. Since the Torah instructs us to do so, the merit is certainly real. It is real even before we find it. But by expressing it verbally, we reveal it.
We reveal it. That means to say, if the Torah teaches us, you should always judge a person favorably, it means there is something favorable. The Torah is true. It's not we make up stories. Must be there is something good about it, and we have to find it. And by finding it, we're revealing it. What's the proof for it? Okay, we'll let Mr. Apple to continue.
We find a similar concept on the reverse side. Regarding negative speech, the sages teach, negative speech kills three people, the speaker, the listeners, and the subject. Question is raised, how is the subject at fault? Jewish ethicists explain that the negative speech we are discussing is factually accurate, for otherwise it would be categorized as slander. So long as the subject's negativity is concealed, he isn't punished for it. But when the negativity is expressed through the negative speech, it is revealed and he becomes liable for punishment.
I'll tell you what this is. Mr. A talks to Mr. B, gossip about Mr. C, right? Then that Mr. A is being punished, understood, he speaks. Mr. B is being punished, he listens. If he wouldn't listen, Mr. A wouldn't be able to talk. He cannot talk to the wall. But why Mr. C? By speaking bad about Mr. C, we bring it out, we make it a reality. And become, we make it a reality, he's doing it, and then he gets punished by it. That's a problem. When I say, speak about another person, he doesn't even hear it. He's such a mean guy, he's such a this and such a this. By saying it, I create a reality. I bring out the bad of the person and bring it out into a reality, and he will actually act on it, and then he will be punished. Yeah. Absolutely. It's your word have an effect. And therefore, it's so important to not speak negative. Because speaking negative about a person, you actually make him into a negative person. It's almost he lives up to your expectation. He's a bad boy. He will be a bad boy. You say he will be a good boy. He will be a good boy. He doesn't even have to hear it. By you expecting that he should be the bad boy, it's going to happen. You're creating realities by speaking about it. That's why it's so important to be positive in Judaism. I mean, in general, but it's very big about it. The same thing is here. That's why the Baal Shem, Judaism says that with every story, you must find something good. By finding good about the person, you bring this out. You bring out the good in them. That's why the Hasidic rabbis were so busy from the Baal Shem Tov to finding good about people, because by saying it, you're creating it, you're bringing this out in them.
That's very good, Rabbi. That's very good.
Thank you. I needed a compliment, and thank you. You helped me. You brought out the best of me. Go ahead.
We can therefore deduce that the underlying concept is all the more true when we highlight the merit in others, that through doing so, we reveal their innate goodness.
Mm-hmm. We reveal the innate goodness. That's amazing. And the Rebbe brings a story from the Alter Rebbe about very interesting story, very unusual story. Go ahead.
Murder with positive intentions. There is an incredible
story. A murder with positive intentions sounds already good, right?
There is an incredible story related about the founder of Chabad, the Alter Rebbe, in one of the recently arrived manuscripts. Source 6A, manuscript 1280, the Chabad Library. I heard a story from the Alter Rebbe that someone was brought to him who was deranged, and at that time he was with some distinguished people. The Rebbe said, in relation to the killing of Zechariah.
Okay, deranged. What's deranged exactly?
Nuts.
It's called a D-book. You remember, you know, there's the movies D-book, D-book. A person came with a D-book. You went crazy. The possessed, exactly. That's the right word. The possessed by another power. You see, it's not the person that you know. It's a different person. Something to cover. Dibuk is a Hebrew word, yeah, but sure. Devin, from the word there, yeah. Dibuk is a Hebrew word, yes. What does the story with Zechariah? Zechariah was a prophet in the time of the first temple. There was two Zechariahs, but he's talking about the guy who was in the first temple. Go ahead. Dr. Lang, continue.
They lived in the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and they worshiped idols. There was wrath upon Judah and Jerusalem because of this, their guilt. God sent prophets among them to return them to the Lord. The prophets warned the people, but they did not pay attention.
Very surprising, right? The Jewish people did the wrong thing. They worshiped idols. The God is sending prophets. They speak to them. The people don't listen. Okay. So far, we know. It's known. Continue.
The Spirit of God enveloped Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest.
Mm-hmm.
He stood above the people and said to them, "So said God, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord? You will not succeed because you have forsaken the God and he has forsaken you." The people conspired against him and stoned him by the in the forecourt of the house of the Lord.
A prophet of God stands on Yom Kippur inside the temple and warns the Jews. And they killed them inside the temple. Mm. It was, I think, 100 years before the destruction of the temple. I think something, I don't remember exactly, but something. Here comes the Alter Rebbe and says what really happened there. Go ahead.
It is known regarding prophecy that the line of the prophet has not verbalized the prophecy and still the plan for the not coming to fruition. Once it has been verbalized, it must be fulfilled. However, when the prophet fills a heavenly urged prophecy, he must do so, whether positive or negative prophecy. Otherwise, he is liable for death.
Oh, a prophecy, the moment God says it, the moment the prophet says it, it becomes a reality. It's much harder to nullify it. It could be, but it's much harder. But as long as it doesn't, but if it, or the prophet, if he doesn't say his prophecy, deserves that. You know, Jonah did not want to prophesy, and therefore he ran away from God. And he was drowning. He knew he deserves it. He said, because of me. Why because of me? Because if he doesn't deliver the prophecy, he deserves that. He must say his prophecy. What happened to him? This, go ahead.
Zechariah was killed. They did not want him to verbalize his prophecy about the temple having destruction. Then it would certainly be destroyed. If his prophecy wouldn't be verbalized, there would still be hope that the decree would be revoked and the temple would be spared.
Okay, what happened is Zechariah was not just saying them, guys, be good guys. No, it was much more than that. He told them the temple will be destroyed. They were so upset, they didn't want him to say the word. They wanted to, they tried to kill him before the word came out from his mouth. They did it for the sake of the temple, not because they wanted to kill him. They said, be quiet. Don't even say such words. Continue, Jared.
What did they do?
And they did so with great sacrifice. Nevertheless, their plan was thwarted, and Zechariah verbalized the prophecy before being killed. And the temple was indeed destroyed later.
What happened is they took a risk. They knew that killing a prophet and Yom Kippur in their holy temple is a terrible thing. You cannot get worse than that. But saving the temple is even more important. They said, no matter what you do, everything is worth to sacrifice to save the temple. That's what they were thinking. But he had a chance to say it before he was killed, and the temple was destroyed. That's the Alter, then what the Alter Rebbe is going, Gumil is going to continue.
This raises a question on Zechariah. Why did he not quell his prophets? Yes, he would be liable to death, but he should have given his life to spare the destruction of all the temple.
Yeah, if they were ready to kill him, just not to see, and they knew they will deserve a big punishment for it. To do such a thing on Yom Kippur inside the temple to kill a prophet, just to save the temple. Why he? He should say, I'll die. It's anything it's worth it, not to destroy the temple. Why the question, why Zechariah didn't want to do what Jonah did? What Jonah tried to do? What's the answer?
The answer is that Zechariah was on such a lofty level that since he knew God wanted the temple destroyed, he could see nothing else.
Aha, he saw Zechariah That is when it was so connected that it couldn't, that the temple was, the will of God is bigger than the light that comes out from the level that we get from spirituality from the temple. The will of God, there is Ratzon. The will of God comes from a deeper place. And from this place, there doesn't make a difference if there is a temple or not. If God doesn't want a temple, it's bigger than that. Then there will be no temple. Then we don't need a temple. If this is not the will of God, if God doesn't want a temple, then we don't need a temple. Ultimately, it's the will of God. And that's where...
It doesn't matter what the prophet says or not, because the will of God is going
to
happen.
No, because he knew that the will of God, therefore he had no problem to say it. That's what he is
expecting. Well, there's no point killing the prophet because it's the will of God anyway.
We're talking about them. We are talking about, they did not reach to this level. The prophet was on this level, that the will of God was higher than everything. The regular person on the street, he says, well, I want the temple. He did not reach to this connection with God, that the will of God is above everything.
I was saying that the prophecy is not spoken. It won't come true yet, but it is going to come true. So it's on Hashem. So it's going to come true no matter whether that prophet speaks it or not. So there's no point in killing
them. Are you right? You're talking about why they killed them. I'm saying they did not reach to this level. They don't know that, so to speak. It's not what you say. You're trying to avoid it. Avoid by all cost. With the prophet is deeper, is more connected, and he says you cannot avoid the will of God. Okay, then what happened? Continue.
After Rabbi said that justification for the killers of Sharia, man regains mental function. The author Rabbi told the distinguished individuals that this man had the same soul as the Sharia's killers, and now his issue had been rectified. I heard the story from Rabbi Akashi.
What the author Rabbi did by finding something positive on the killers of Zechariah, he brought a tikkun to this soul, and the soul left him. The dibuk left them. This person probably was a connection to this from this soul, and the soul couldn't find rest for many, many generations until he had to find something good about the soul, and by this, bringing him to peace. He should be able to rest in peace. This is an introduction. Why the Rebbe was so busy with Miriam Bas Bilgo to find something good about her. Finding the good in every situation. Go ahead.
Apply this to our discussion with Miriam Bas Bilgo. While we certainly can consider ourselves comparable to the old Rebbe, once we pave the path to road, while we pave the path, the road is open for all of us.
It means the Rebbe said, not the Alter Rebbe, but the moment the Alter Rebbe did it, everybody can do it. That's the idea.
The Baal Shem Tov was related. I heard in the name of Rabbi Yosef Karo that he once exerted himself greatly until he succeeded in explaining a difficult Torah matter. Later, he heard others giving the same explanation as a matter of course, and he felt bad about all of his efforts. Yeah. The Arizal explained to him that he had paved the way for this explanation and it is now easily accepted.
You know, sometimes big doctors, for example, or big scientists, or base every chokhem, comes up with an amazing idea. You worked years on it. Then you come to some other convention and some 23-year-old boy gets up and he says the same thing. And you like, your blood goes down. I can't believe it. I stole it from me. We really saw it. It's mine. It's plagiarism. It's not plagiarism. It didn't. So the moment you reveal this concept in the world, everybody else can. It's for easy. For you, you were paving the way. You had to walk on it years. But the moment you revealed it in the world, in the atmosphere, then everybody can pick up on it. Much easier. That means to say, great revelation that some genius has had to work very hard. The moment they explain it, everybody somehow it comes to other people's mind. That's what the story with the Bet Yosef. He was the author of the code of Jewish law. Then he worked done something very hard, and then he heard that somebody else is saying it, and he was like, "Oh, what's going on here?" And don't worry. You said you revealed the idea. You invented it. But now everybody can go on the internet. They can find it. What is this? What was bothering? Now we come to the real punchline of the whole story. Go ahead. What? Oh, they should say, yeah. I forgot about you guys. Mrs. Kosoff, would you mind to continue to read me?
What's bothering her? In addition to relating how Miriam bat Bilga kicked the altar, the Talmud also records the argument she made against the altar. Wolf, wolf, for how long will you continue to consume the property of the Jewish people and yet fail to assist them when they are in trouble? Consider, this is a Jewish girl who deteriorated to the state of apostasy and married a Greek soldier. When the Greeks conquered Jerusalem and the temple and entered the sanctuary in their impure state in order to bring a pig as a sacrifice, Miriam came along with them. Yet despite this all, what's important to Miriam bat Bilga and bothers her is the terrible situation of the Jewish people. This is what leads her to cry out, wolf, wolf, for how long will you continue to consume the property of the Jewish people and yet fail to assist them when they are in trouble? Her complaint is why the altar isn't protecting the Jewish people. Why isn't it helping them?
See what's going on. The Rebbe says, look what's going on here. Well, look what the Jewish girl is. She went so low, couldn't get any lower than that. She converted to Christianity. She denied her family. She married, not Christianity, she converted to that religion, whatever the religion it was, the time of the Greeks, that there was the Zeus, Christ was. And then she married an officer. She enters the temple with them. But then she sees the altar. What bothers her? Why you don't help the Jewish people? That's what bothers her. That means no matter how low a Jewish girl can reach, in the end of the end, she cares for the Jewish people. And she turns to God and said, who is the altar? Who the altar represents? God. She takes her shoe, eats the altar, says, why? Where are you? That's what bothers her. Doesn't bother her what she's not celebrating the demise of the Jewish people. In the worst situation, no matter how far she goes, what bothers her? Bothers her the Jewish people. And we saw it now, really, during the time of October 7. I saw people who went so far that you cannot believe how far they are. And somehow something woke them up on October 7. And they couldn't control themselves and being so upset and crying and going crazy. Why the world, what happened to the Jews in the other side of the world by the Hamas, right? They live in America, they live in Cleveland, and because there is something in the neshama of the Jew that no matter how low you reach, you can never lose the connection. And that's the story. David says the story doesn't say something bad about Miriam bat Bilga. It's actually a compliment. It shows how strong the connection of a Jewish person, no matter how low he reaches. That's what's so important there. When the Rebbe said that he was crying, there is a tape from it, and we can hear the other Rebbe speaking about it. What's the lesson? Dr. Kosov, you want to continue to read another paragraph?
The lesson from the story of Miriam bat Bilga is that everything depends on us. We must capitalize on the opportunity.
You have to raise it up.
Raise it up.
Well, I think he should be starting here.
Though. Oh, you should have started.
Okay, don't worry.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't read the first paragraph. I'm sorry, read the first paragraph. This story contains a lesson for us.
In our time, it is difficult to find a Jew who has fallen as low as Miriam bat Bilga. But we do see people that externally appear to be acting improperly, and when we challenge them, they don't deny it. We can therefore be intimidated and think to ourselves, what connection do I have with such a Jew? The lesson from the story of Miriam bat Bilga is that everything depends on us. We must capitalize on the opportunity that divine providence has given us and use our encounter with this person to speak to them warmly with words that come from the heart. When we speak from our heart, our words will enter their heart and have an impact, transforming this Jew into our neighbor who follows the path of Torah and mitzvot, just like us, as it says, good for the righteous, good for his neighbor.
It means to say we meet a Jew, we think he's so bad, he's as bad as Miriam Bas Bilgo. No, go talk to him. There is a chance. There is a neshama there. There is somebody to bring out. And that was really the Rebbe's mission, life mission. The Rebbe didn't only believe in God. He believed in the Jews. He believed in every Jew. That in every Jew there is a neshama. If you really believe in God, you believe in every person. There is an inner good in him, and you have to wake up this neshama. Even a Miriam Bas Bilgo can come back.